Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge and this is the show where I review every single science fiction book that I read as I read it. There's no set schedule, it's just whenever I finish a book, I forget about it for about 2 weeks and then do the review and then put it up here on the podcast feed for everyone to listen to. I think that's the kind of thing that's gone on for the last few books that I've done. I've always done the review and then sort of put off the review for a long time. This time, I actually just was working on other stuff and I completely forgot about it. What happened was that I finished the book and then the next day I had a visitor over and then the next day I went to a 5-day juggling festival in Italy and had an awesome time and I actually started another book, Lord of Light by Roger Zelazny, which I actually started before, but that was an audiobook that I was continuing to listen to, and that wasn't really working for me as an audiobook because I had to go back and listen to every chapter twice, you know, just to make sure that I've paid enough attention to pick up anything I needed. And then I listened to I Am Legend as an audiobook and finished that as well, and I read two other non-fiction books as well. And then when I looked up which episode I Am Legend was going to be when I did the podcast for it, which I was planning on doing today after finishing the book yesterday, I realized that I completely forgotten about Ubik by Philip K. Dick, which is today's book, or this episode's book that I'm going to be reviewing today. I have actually been working on other stuff as well in that time as well, mostly just having a life, but continuing some other writing projects and some other podcasting projects as well. Thanks to everyone who offered to read through the first part of my new fantasy novel that I'm working on as well. Hopefully I'm going to get some feedback from people soon about that, and it'll get me, hopefully make me inspired to continue with the next second half of that book, or I'd say the second two-thirds of that book, and get it all done. I guess I might as well just get straight into today's review as well. Again, sorry that I'm doing another review almost 2 weeks after I finished the book, but I still think quite a lot of this is clear in my mind even after forgetting it for a while. So, Ubik by Philip K. Dick. I think this is the first book by Philip K. Dick that I've reviewed here on the podcast. In fact, I'm quite sure it is. But I have talked about some of his short stories and other things on the SFF audio podcast a few episodes ago. I was a guest and we talked about one of his short stories, and over the years I've been doing that podcast, it's come up time and time again. So this was written in 1969, 224 pages long, and I decided to read this one because there's this SF Masterworks series, and I think there's like something like 80 books in the series at the moment, and this list meme thing going around asking how many you've read, and it's a pretty good list. So if you've read all of those books, you've got a pretty good founding in sort of science fiction classics and masterworks, or whatever they're called. And out of the 80, I read about 40 of them, but there were a few books that I wasn't quite sure if I'd read them or not from authors who I've read quite a bit of them, but you know, 10 years later after I read quite a few of Philip K. Dick's works 10 years ago or longer ago, and all these other authors as well, and I can't remember which book I read and which book I haven't read, and things like that. So I decided to pick up Ubik in the Masterworks volume. It's right here on my desk. It's got a nice picture of a lady on the front, who I can guess that is from the story. And I'll just read out a little bit out on the back of this. It goes, Glenn Runciter is dead, or is he? Someone died in the explosion, orchestrated by his business rivals. But even as his funeral is scheduled, his mourning employees are received. The thing is, if I read the back of the book, it sort of spoils loads of stuff. Okay, I'm going to forget the reading in the back of the book. I'll do my own summing up of the book here. First I'll talk about the setting of the book. It's set in, I think, 1992, and in this weird future as viewed from 1969. Man has reached the moon again, I guess. Well, I guess people were going to the moon in 1969, so it was all new that, of course, we'll be still going to the moon in 1992, and they've reached other planets as well. And it's not really important to the story except one way, which is obvious right from the very beginning of the book. Apart from space travel and other technology that's come along, there's two new developments which are quite important. One is psi abilities has been discovered, so people can do things like read other people's minds and influence thoughts and things like that. And others have the anti-psi ability to dampen those abilities of the people who can read minds. They work in the other way around. So when they're hanging out, the mind readers can't read minds. So Glenn Runciter, he owns a company which provides anti-psi operations, this dampening effect to stop people from, you know, spying on different companies. It's all about business espionage and things like that. So he sets up this company with his wife, and it's all very, very successful. The second development is one where we find out quite soon, because his wife is dead. but she's still helping out with the business. And the way it works is this, that when someone is very, very near death, like in almost in the instant of death, they're put into a mortuary, frozen, and then they're kept alive in what's known as the half-life in some kind of, cold suspension thing. And so if you go to the mortuary, you can actually talk to the dead people and get advice on them how to run your business. And this is what Runsetter does to, I think it's Ella, her name is. And so she's, but all at the same time, she is slowly being subsumed by the group mind that pervades all of the dead people within the mortuary. So they're all sort of, all the minds are slowly linking together and things like that. And that's pretty much the setup for the book. Another main character of the book is called Joe Chip. And Chip works for Runsetter, and his job is to spot the new anti-Psy talented people and bring them into the company. He doesn't have any Psy abilities himself. He's our normal Joe. And so Joe Chip, he's hanging out. And also, he's always broke because in the future, money... is sort of like a really tricky thing to deal with because everything costs money. If you want to open the door to your fridge, you've got to pay your fridge. And if you want to open the door to your apartment, you've got to pay the apartment. If you want to make a phone call, you've got to pay your own phone in your own house and things like that. So you get some very funny scenes when he's arguing with his door or with a fridge and he's going, I'll tell you what, I'll borrow some money. I'll pay you in the future. And the door's going, no, you said that to me last week. You know. So that's a weird kind of satire kind of thing going on there too. So the story... is a little bit troubling, which is why I started reading the back of the book and then decided to give up, because it's a Philip K. Dick story, and so it's really difficult to say what the book is about or the kind of things that go on without spoiling it, because at every 20th page in this book, how many pages are there? Yeah, 200 and something pages. Every 20th page, on average, we get a twist. Someone is revealed to be working for someone else, or everything that we thought up until this point is a lie, and it's actually going in this direction, you know, and like reality changes at different points throughout the book, and the characters have to sort of work out what's going on. So throughout the book, you get different characters going, well, what is going on? What is going on? What's going on over here? What's going on over here? Well, it must be this. And they're going, oh, I'm not sure. Does that fit all the facts? So actually within the book is always a constant discussion of what is real and what is truth and what is going on and stuff like that. So as the readers, if you're reading through this book, you really have no chance to keep up. And if I sort of explain what's going on, it's a bit tricky for me to say, because let me just explain this. At the beginning, an agent comes to Chip and she has a new sort of anti-Psy talent. And it's a weird anti-Psy talent because this girl can sort of change the representation of time. And she can then select something in the past, change it. Or she can select something in the past that someone else has perceived, change it. And then the present becomes different. And she convinces Chip that she should be hired by Runsetter. And sort of Chip works out. Now, this is right at the very beginning of the book. And you think, oh, wow, someone being able to change the recent past. This is going to be the main point of the novel. And again, it's a little bit of a spoiler, but I just say, no, that's not the main point of the novel. You think it's going to be the main point of the novel. It's actually it could be an entire novel itself. But we sort of explore this for about 20 pages and then, oh, on to the next thing as well. So then Runsetter gets this big contract and he has to take the anti-Psy squad. Oh, no, sorry. At the beginning of the book, we find out there's this active Psy guy, this the most powerful Psy operative mind reader in the world, but then they can't track him down anywhere. None of the other anti-Psy operatives can find him anywhere. Oh yeah, and then what happens is that Runsetter gets a big contract and has to take the anti-Psy squad to the moon, where, as you've already guessed it, that's where the active Psy people are hiding out, and it's all a trap. So that was quite obvious when they're going, oh, we can't find them anywhere, we can't track them anywhere on Earth, and then they're going, well, let's go to the moon. It's like, well, okay, I think these two things are going to be connected. So that's not too much of a spoiler. And like I say, I wanted that part of that kind of like industrial espionage story to continue, but then it doesn't. It takes another turn, another twist, and I've already spoiled a bit of it here, but the big problem is I found some of the twists in the beginning of the book more interesting than those later on. Like there's these different tricks that Chip uses when he's working, you know, he's working with, you know, doing, well, he's doing his job. But again, I don't want to give it away. And he has knowledge and he used that knowledge in a clever way. And you as the reader don't see what it is. And then you, it's revealed to you and it sort of changes the direction of the story. And some of the tricks you'll pick up on them, some of the twists you'll pick up on, and others, the character's a little bit too, you know, a bit too clever. And it, that kind of thing also continues throughout the book, these, like, twists and mysteries. Some of them you can see coming, some of them you can tell who's working behind the scenes and all that kind of stuff. But then there's other parts later on where it's revealed that, you know, everything Chip or any of the other characters think is going on isn't going on, and that all their actions up until that point have been pointless. And in some ways that's interesting from, like, a thematic kind of point of view, and it's actually a lot of fun and it raises different points, but I don't find those kind of twists interesting. It's like when sometimes when you get to the end of a you get to the end of a movie and they just go, oh yeah, and it was all a dream, and you just think, well, it wasn't about dreams, it wasn't about that, you know, it wasn't about reality. But thankfully this book is, but sometimes those big twists where they just go, oh, and everything now is different from what you thought before, and all the characters are going, what's happening, it's like I say, those twists I wouldn't mind spoiling in a way, but some of the twists at the beginning of the book, which I sort of have spoiled, were some of my favourite bits and pieces, when we do have a bit more basis in reality and then we find out what's really going on. That's really interesting. If we have no basis in reality and then later on we find that this basis, no basis in reality, isn't correct, and that we actually have to now look at another basis in a different reality, not so satisfying when this kind of thing isn't tied down. So in a way I quite like the mundane twists rather than the fantastic twists. And then right at the very end of the book, then there was, you know, the last page of the book, or, you know, the last chapter 17 is like a page and a half, and you think, oh, okay, this is going to explain it all, and it doesn't. It then twists it again, and which is, you know, to be expected in a book like this. And again, it's sort of like, oh, another twist, and it sort of goes, throws the entire book into question, and then you're going, well, it's not interesting anymore. If the entire book is just a series of twists, I think each one of them has to be either cleverer than the last one, or more momentous, or follow logically in some way, or just be interesting. I don't know. But then when it gets to that point in the book, I don't know, it was just a little bit disappointing, even though I can sort of see what it's going. It is not confusing, and I guess I get into the thematic part of this review later on. And so in some ways, while some of the plot twists weren't actually that good or that satisfying, the individual episodes between them and that led on from these kind of things are actually really, really good fun. Like I was saying at the beginning of the book, you've got this industrial espionage kind of stuff going on and the weird time twisting stuff. And then later on, there's another time travel aspect, and they go back to 1939 in, you know, the United States in 1939, just before the United States, or just before the Second World War. And they're not quite sure what the United States is going to do, if they're going to get involved or not. And then there's another part, which is the murder mystery part, where people are dying and Chip tries to find out who's responsible, and the way that people are dying is really, really creepy, and really, really, you know, cool in a horror kind of way. And then there's this whole like 20 pages of just Chip climbing a flight of stairs, and he's, like I say, like 20 pages of one person climbing a flight of stairs and trying to make his way to his hotel room. And it's, and as I was reading this, I was like, how can this be so interesting? It's like one of my favorite bits of writing in a long time, and it's just some guy climbing the stairs, but the imagery and the ideas and the themes that are being expressed at that point are really, really interesting. So, story-wise, hit and miss. Parts of it exciting, parts of it interesting, but overall I found that it was very much of a mess. It felt like Philip K. Dick was going, right, I'm going to write this, and then the next time he came to sit down and write the next part, he's going, well, okay, just imagine that everything I've written up until now is, you know, tentative. And then he just keeps writing, and then the next time he comes and sits down and writes, you know, another 30 pages, he's got other ideas that he wants to put in there as well. So it's a little bit messed up. The characters, not a lot to say here, because the character's not very interesting. You know, Chip is, you know, just one guy doing this kind of stuff, but the point of view at one point, like the narration point of view, switches from him to another character, and I didn't notice for a while. All the characters like subsumed by the plot and the ideas and the weirdness going on, and nothing is character driven after a point, you know, because everything is just weirdness driven. If reality isn't real, let me put it this way, if something needs to happen, or if someone needs to do something because Philip K. Dick wants to take the story in another direction, he just writes that they do that. But then again, if the reality is being created by the characters as they go along, in some cases, as often happens in Philip K. Dick books as well, other characters can be logically bent to illogical actions if that's required by the characters who are like direct. I've lost control of the ascendant. Anyway, many, many rabbit holes to go down to, and all of the characters are subsumed, like I say, by the weirdness and by these different rabbit holes. They just exist to go along, and some of them exist just to die. And there's one character who turns out to be very important. I don't really want to give that too much away there as well. Moving on, though, to science and technology stuff in the book. Elevators. Did you know that once elevators didn't exist and people had to climb stairs or ladders, and then they were cages controlled by pulling on ropes, and then they were boxes with attendants who would control them, you know, and actually someone was paid to do it, and then they were electric or maybe hydraulic, but they still needed an attendant to press the buttons and pull the levers and make the lift stop at the right floor, and then they were controlled by buttons and you would press them, and then they were computer controlled, and then they were controlled by your voice and you had to put money in them to call them and the money in them to make them go up or down, and if you didn't have enough money you might be stuck in the lift. And then anyway, I'm saying all of this because there is a time travel part of this book, and the way that characters know that they are traveling in time is that technology changes around them. They turn up somewhere and the technology has changed. And again, to avoid spoilers, I won't go into it too much here, but this same idea, this same theme is repeated with many, many, many other technologies. It's about, you know, music players and cars and planes and all of the different stuff all of the different technology that they have in the future. We also see the technology that leads up to that conceptually, in a sort of like the next level down in the sort of platonic form layers, I guess that's one way to look at it. Anyway, so I don't really want to go too much into science and technology here, but it's some wacky stuff, some interesting stuff in this book. Writing style, might as well talk about that for a bit. Philip K. Dick, a little bit... Well, in some ways, it is a style, but in this book, it certainly starts off a bit clunky. It took me actually a few times to read through the first chapter of this book, and then I put the book down and was like, can I be bothered with this? And then I picked it up again and started again. But once you get into the book, it starts really, you know, the conversations start picking up. Otherwise, sometimes the conversation's a little bit pedestrian, but the action never stops and people are always rushing to do the next thing. And I actually normally quite like that writing style where character is like, okay, we're not going to spend too much time in the character's head. They're not going to be looking at too much stuff. There's not going to be too much description. We're going to strip all of that away and you know, focus on moving characters through the story. Except here, the characters are so flat that it's almost impossible to care about them. And there's only like a few people that you care about. And it's when at one point when the book really slows down and we get inside, you know, Joe Chip's thought process, and then you sort of start caring about him. And then when someone turns up to stop him, then you sort of really start hating that other person. Whereas up until that point, I really didn't care very much about the protagonist. I really didn't care too much about the antagonist or anything like that. And also, there's very little subtlety in terms of writing. There's subtlety in other places, but in terms of writing, it's just laid out there, and the only way that any meaning is hidden is by lies. It's just like, oh, this is true. Oh, no, it's not true. But I often like it within writing to sort of hint at things and to sort of mention things and to point things out in a way. You go, okay, this is this, and this is this, and this person's wearing that, and they're also wearing this. And you think, oh, that last thing that you mentioned throws the whole rest of that in a different light. Whereas in this book, it's just like, okay, they were wearing that. And you think, anything else that I need to know about that? It's like, no, that's it. And you go, well, what about that last detail, which will throw the whole thing? It reminds me of, I can't remember what the movie was, but someone... It was Man on the Moon. The story of... forgotten the comedian's name. Anyway, always playing tricks on everyone, messing up with other people's brains, and is always, you know, setting things up as real and then they're not. I can't believe I've forgotten the comedian's name now. And at one point, a doctor comes in and says, "Yes, He's dying, and then the doctor walks out, and I think it's his sister in the movie. Anyway, his sister goes, "I don't believe you. The doctor was wearing red shoes. Doctors don't wear red shoes. Doctors wear black shoes or brown shoes. No doctor wears red shoes. This isn't real. This isn't that." And it was just sort of like that last little detail that was mentioned there. And of course, that's a bit too blatant. And that's the level that we have here in this book, is that everything is too blatant. It's like when a character comes in, they're actually described as, because it's in the future, and they're described as wearing this kind of stuff and that kind of stuff, and just this really wacky outfit. But then there's no character that comes in and is just wearing a suit and tie. Everyone who comes in is always wearing just wacky stuff. And I'm thinking, well, if we just had that one description, which was a little bit more, you know, a little bit more set. But like I said, I don't know what I'm trying to say there. But a weird look. Maybe it is subtle. Maybe there were some subtle hints like that. I just didn't pick up on it. The book is very funny in places. Maybe I'll get into that later. I just don't think it's that well written compared to other Philip K. Dick stories. It switches between viewpoints in this really clumsy way. In a way that, like, maybe it's, again, maybe Philip K. Dick is just way more intelligent than me and way more of a talented writer than I am a talented reader, and that I didn't pick up on the reason why he was switching between viewpoints so clumsily. I can see why he wanted to switch between viewpoints, because he wanted to get different takes on the same situation. He wanted to take people through the story or through different experiences more than once, and it was a really interesting way to do that, but just the way it switches, very, very clumsy. Which brings me on to, I guess, the final part of this review, to the themes of it. There's, like I said before, being trapped in your home and you can't get food and you can't leave because you've got no money. You've run out of quarters. And it's a great comment on commercialism, but also not just commercialism, but I really like the idea that this is talking about, like, being trapped in poverty, because Joe Chip is stuck in his house and, like, the door is going, "No, you can't come out. You haven't paid me for the last time you left the apartment." He's like, "Yeah, just lend me some money. I'll get it back to you." And the door's going, no, just put the quarter in, you can leave. And then he goes over to the fridge and he's like, "Come on, I want to get into the fridge." And the fridge is going, "Nope, you didn't pay me for last time." He's like, "Oh, I'll borrow it in the future." And I really like the idea that, you know, the kind of commercialism, the constant draining of money, but it's like he's in an apartment. Where is he going to get a quarter to put a quarter into the fridge or the quarter into the door if he's not allowed to eat so he can earn money to be able to put a quarter into the door, and he's not allowed to leave the apartment to get some more quarters because, you know, it's a bit strange thing about it. It's a clever way, I think, of talking about poverty and commercialism as well, like that. So it's good satire. All of this kind of thing. But I do think it was sort of missing a key element, like the satire of that, like the commercialism aspect, really didn't affect the story much at all, or if at all. You know, the only time it did was when Chip noticed, you know, he got a coin and someone said, "Oh, this coin is from a different time period." And he's like, "Oh yeah, so it is." And that kind of thing sets off, you know, a bit more of the, you know, a bit of the story going in a different direction. But generally, the commercialism satire stands apart from the other thematic explorations, as you know, as far as my reading goes. And maybe if I read it again, I might be able to pick up some more stuff in the early and middle parts of the book here. Another theme is, what is Ubik? It's called Ubik or Ubik or Ubik or however you want to pronounce it. And Ubik we're told that has the root of the word is ubiquity or ubiquitous. However, the ubiquitous Ubik isn't actually ubiquitous. It's actually really quite difficult to get. And it's in a bottle, and it's a spray. I'm not going to go into what it's for. But people like Chip have to strive towards it. He really, really needs it, and it's really, really difficult for him to get it. And only it will do him any good when it's in one form, and it's going to save him, or at least he thinks it's going to save him. And then you go, well, will it save him? Well, maybe, but then maybe not. And along the way, we find that maybe it does save people, or maybe it doesn't save people. But like I say, gives people something to aim for, and it's like hope. In the way that I look at it, it's either hope or faith in a bottle, because people think that it's everywhere. Hope is everywhere and faith is everywhere, but it's actually really difficult, and it's only useful in one form, and it might not even be useful at all anyway. So we've got this great really interesting, I thought this was the most interesting thematic part for me, is that this afterlife that they have, which is this half-life, I mentioned it before, but you know, you've got to survive to get to the half-life, because, and it's a technological half-life, it's a technological afterlife, and then when you get there, you've got to survive too, and we find this out in the very first chapter of the book, because, you know, Runciter visits Ella, his wife, and you know, things are going wrong in there, and she needs to be able to survive as well, and stuff is happening. I'm talking page 19-20 here in the book, so I'm not spoiling too much, but again, that theme continues throughout the book, is that you've got to be able to have it, and Ubik is something which may or may not help you. It may or may not exist. It may or may not be there for any purpose at all. And like I say, it's all based with the afterlife, about heaven and hell, about reincarnation, faith, destiny. It's all mixed up in there as well. And it's a really good satire on that kind of stuff. But then again, it's very confused because there's so much imagery in there. I've just mentioned a bit, but like 200 pages of this kind of stuff, it's difficult to provide any real meaning or structure. It's like, what is Philip K. Dick actually trying to say here? That heaven is acquiring and taking drugs? Is that what heaven is about? Drug taking? I don't know. Maybe it is. But, you know, and in a way, this may be what I don't like about satire so much. You know, satire is sometimes good, but so often it doesn't really have a positive point. It only serves to skewer beliefs, and that's what this book is doing. It's skewering the, you know, the afterlife beliefs, beliefs in faith, beliefs in religion, all that kind of stuff. But once you accept that, there's very little to grasp hold of once you accept Philip K. Dick's skewering of these kind of things, except maybe drugs are good? I don't know. Final theme that I pick up on as well, or that I'm going to talk about here, is the idea of what is reality. And this is one of Philip K. Dick's one theme that he is most interested in, but I think this is one of his least interesting works because it has so much to do with that. In this book, reality is pretty much it's not out of control, but it's out of your control. It's out of the character's control. It's out of you, the reader. He's telling you that reality is out of your control. And you might think that you got it worked out, but you probably don't have it all worked out. And then when you think you've got it worked out, well, actually, you probably don't have it worked out. Like I say, this every 20 pages, you go, like, the rabbit hole takes another twist and you go into a different direction. And taking it to this level, reality loses its meaning. And that's if the layer above you can also be the layer below you, and the twist in front of you can also be the twist behind you. And also, if the first layer can also be the last layer, it's not just that, yeah, you know, it's like reality isn't real anymore. There isn't any kind of base reality, which, again, is kind of maybe that's why I found the ending of this book a bit of a cheat, and it sort of makes me a bit annoyed that you get through all of that and you just go, okay, well, I can see what you're trying to do here. Maybe I've just not done enough drugs. Maybe I think this could be actually, maybe my perception of that, yeah, my perception sort of corresponds with some kind of objective reality in a way that I can rely on in my daily life. And every time I sort of test reality, it sort of kind of holds up to my scrutiny. And if it doesn't, I'm in a dream and then I wake up. Although there was one specific time which wasn't to do with drug taking, which I actually felt like I was in a different reality. What happened was that it was maybe, 10 years ago now, maybe a bit more than that, and I was going down to Manchester to meet up with my brother. He was working for an organisation which did theatre shows in schools, and the first 3 weeks of September or October, I can't remember what month it was, they do this kind of boot camp where they get in all the people who are going to be working in these theatre companies which are going to go out and all these schools and talk to kids about, I don't know, drug taking or God or whatever it was about. So it's that kind of sort of like school theatre thing. And so they have this 3 weeks of training, and then they have like this graduation show, and all of the students get together there, and all the parents of the students get together. These are the sort of theatre students who are going to go out and do this kind of stuff. They graduate, and then they go out and spend a year touring around schools. Now, my brother had done this a few years, and then he was teaching there and doing something in the show. I can't actually remember what it was. But I turned up there, and just imagine, maybe there's a few hundred people. Maybe say 120 people, plus lots of other people, like parents and things like that, who don't know Nathan. But the 120 people do know Nathan, but they've only known him for 3 weeks, and it probably hasn't come up. that he has an identical twin brother. There's many people that I meet and hang out for a long time, unless I'm sort of talking about brothers and sisters or other things like that. Yeah, I won't mention that I've got an identical twin brother. So then I turn up and Nathan's not there. But everybody there, except for the few people I'd met before, they all thought I was Nathan. And they're like, hey, Nathan, you got to do that. And then I was like, no, I'm not Nathan. I'm actually his twin brother. And they're like, ha, very funny, Nathan. Let's do this now. And I was like, no, I'm his identical twin brother. But remember, this was like a theater kind of group. And so it's exactly the kind of place where maybe Nathan is probably the kind of person who would actually play a joke like that on people, like a few hours before this, this graduation ceremony show kind of thing. And it was really weird. And it felt like I was, you know, Marty McFly, who had gone to the past and change the past, and then when he comes back to the future, everything's changed and everyone's treating him as though he's a different person, or everyone's treating him like he's his own son or anything like that. And that's what it felt like a bit. And it was only like after, it was good like 10 minutes of me like actually talking to people and convincing people that I wasn't Nathan, I was actually somebody's identical twin brother. And that kind of thing has happened before, being an identical twin, like when I went to my sister's wedding. And what happened was that Nathan was around for about a week before the wedding in the town where my sister lived and my parents lived at the time, and I lived in a different city. And then I turned up the morning of the wedding. Now, normally Nathan has longer hair than me and I have shorter hair, but I'd been growing my hair a bit, and then I turn up with longer hair on the morning of the wedding. Also the morning of the wedding, Nathan gets his hair cut short. And we turn up to the wedding, and of course we're both wearing smart clothes, so you can't tell us apart by the clothes because we're wearing wedding clothes. And I guess it was just people's minds. It was always like, okay, Nathan, long hair, Luke, short hair. See them from the side, see them from the back. We've got the same profiles. We've got the same, you know, same shape, same everything like that. We've got basically the same facial features and things like that. And I've got a few more moles. So I've got like a mole just above my lip, which is a good way to tell us apart. But generally, we're very, very similar. And everybody got us mixed up. Everybody. I'm talking like my parents, they couldn't tell us apart. My sisters couldn't tell us apart. My brother's wife just was like, Nathan, Nathan, Nathan. And I wasn't responding, because if Nathan is around, I expect him to respond as well. But she just got the wrong person. And it was, again, one of those weird things where you just go, oh, yeah. But then, of course, you test reality. Oh, that's why I was telling these stories. Yeah, you sort of test reality. And guess what? Reality actually holds up to scrutiny. I've never been in a place where time has skipped. I've never been in a place. I mean, I've had some dreams. I once woke up and got up and had breakfast and had a shower and went to work and then woke up again. And I was like, oh, fuck. I've just got up and did all this stuff. And then I had to do that whole kind of thing again. I've had lucid dreams. But again, reality does hold up. So maybe if I do more drugs, I can actually find the truth. Because there is a truth within this book. But I don't find this book brings me any closer to any truth which means anything to me. It's a version of the truth which means a lot to Philip K. Dick, and it's maybe a version of truth which means a lot to other kind of people, but for me, a book which just talks about reality and doesn't actually bring me any closer to any kind of understanding of reality or any way to look at life and think, okay, maybe reality isn't there and doesn't have any meaning. However, if it doesn't have any meaning and it isn't there, maybe this is the way that you should live life on the off chance, you know, some kind of weird Pascal's wager, just to make sure, you know, say you were living in the Matrix. What would you do to make sure that in the future you're not going to have your brains fed into a computer for energy or whatever goes on in the Matrix and stuff like that? So it didn't really resonate with me on a thematic level in that way. The whole faith kind of thing kind of resonated in a way, but like I say, it was too messy. There was too much stuff going in there, and the satire didn't leave me anything to grab hold of. And like I say, the commercialism kind of theme was funny, but didn't have a lot to do with the rest of the book. So this book is pretty big mess, actually, I think. I think the story is a bit of a mess. The themes are a bit of a mess and don't really resonate with me, although, like I say, I can see how they do it otherwise. I think the writing is a little bit pedestrian at some times, and the characters are very flat. However, like I say, there are certain twists, there are certain events, there are certain horrors within this book, which I actually really enjoyed. However, I do think this is one of the first books that, when I finished reading it, I put the book down and then just forgot to review it for like a week and a half. And then I'm like, oh yeah, that book. I haven't thought about that book since I finished reading it after putting it down. It's a book I forgot about. It's very strange to say that. Anyway, I'm going to give this book 3 stars. I think there's other better Philip K. Dick books to start with. If you want to sort of go into, like, take Philip K. Dick's, like, a smooth entry, read, you know, Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep or A Man in the High Castle for slightly less crazy books. But if you just want to go, okay, what are all the things that Philip K. Dick wants to talk about with all of his fiction, and can I have them, all of them, rammed down my, well, not all of them, but a lot of different ideas that he wants to write about rammed down my throat within 200 pages and just completely bonkers. Yeah, so if you want that kind of stuff, it's a really good first book. Maybe everything is a little bit of a step down from here, but in terms of ideas, but in terms of actual quality of books, I think most of the books of his that I've read, most of the novels of his that I've read anyway, are a step up. So yeah, 3 stars. Now I'll go to goodreads.com and see what other people think. Here we go, friends. No, in total, this gets 4.3 stars. No, 4.03 stars by goodreads.com users in total. But here we go, my friends. 36 friends have reviewed it. And it's a 3.65 average. So generally people... Oh, this is a good... Someone's written a few people have written some reviews here. So here, Brian rated it 4 stars. He says, I'd have paid good money for the chance to follow Philip K. Dick through his morning routine and take some field notes. 8:15 a.m. Subject awake, sits up with... I didn't realize this was going to be a full story. Sits up with perplexed look on his face. Becomes intensely interested in his own toes, which he appears surprised to find wiggling. 8:45 a.m. Emerges from bed only to immediately halt at the bathroom door. Shuffles through nightrobe pockets. No result. Returns to bed, retrieves quarter from his nightstand, and inserts it into a slit between the door and wall. Psst, sound, Dick, not the door, as he opens it. 9 a.m. Subject has begun to shave. Becomes distracted by a hairspray can. Begins conversation. Theology and metaphysics mostly. Descartes, Hume. 10 a.m. Showering now, singing badly in a Gregorian chant. Hairspray has joined him. Subject's tone to it has become reverent, tending towards religious ecstasy. Hey, it's a good job that I'm not the only one who picks up the spray religious iconography going on here as well. Yes, Philip K. Dick is a perfect illustration of genius and lunacy as being separated only by a hair's breadth. Happily, Phil always lands on the genius side. Yeah, and that's, like I was saying before, this book is a mess, and I think that really sums up the writing process. Yeah, you know, Philip K. Dick wandering around his house, seeing something and going, oh, this would make a really good part of the book, going back, writing, stands up, walks away. Oh, look, I've just found something on my desk, goes back, something else on the other side of my desk. What's this over here? There's a good review there. He gives it 4 stars. Yeah, Chris, 5 stars, Scott, 5, yeah, he's got lots of, old Keith Jones, 2 stars. Jason rated at 1 star. Yeah, so it's a bit of a mixed bag here, but it looks good. Eric says, 5 star. Oh, I'm not going to read it out. I've just read one out as well. So Matt rated at 4 stars. I think this was rated in Time Magazine's top 100 English language novels of the 20th century. Well, it is a masterwork series, so I guess quite a few people do regard it highly. But I think if you checked out some of the other masterworks before this one, probably, like I said, I've read 40 of them. You see how many you've read too. So that's it for my review. Next up, I'll be reviewing I Am Legend, which I've already read, and I think I've made some notes as I went along with that one. It's a short book, so it'll probably be quite a quick review as well. Yeah, I'll catch you next time. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Luke Burge on Twitter. You can check my blog, lukeburge.com/blog, or lukeburge.com for all my different kind of stuff, fiction and things like that. You can check out all the show lists as well. Still getting emails from people listening to, was it episode 66, and sending me in notes to tell me that they're listening to that back in time or from the future, or however you want to look at that as well. And what's the other thing? Oh yeah, goodreads.com. Add me on there so I can see what you think about the books that I'm reading. You can also see what I think about the books that you're reading. It's really, really cool. Thanks a lot for listening, and I'll catch you next time.